In this, the beginning of freedom from bondage of self begins with the third step, and it goes through steps 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And at the conclusion of the seventh step, we will have been freed from the bondage of self. At the end of how it works, we're told that there are three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. And that really is, at the end of the second step, I believed that there was a power that could help me. I wasn't restored to sanity. I really had no idea how insane I was, although I related to a lot of stories of someone who was really insane. I lived in a delusional world. I made up the world as it went along, and amazingly, I made up a world that was a bad world. I mean, the more I lived in it, the worse I made it, and I acted in a way to make the world impossible to live in a peaceful way. But at the end of that second step, I believed there was something. I didn't know what it was. When I got to AA, I was an atheist for the second time in my life. And I didn't know how I was going to go back. I read those steps on the wall, and I saw it. I could see a path there. I knew that when I become an atheist that second time, that there was a tremendous hole inside of me. A tremendous hole. And I didn't know how to fill it, and booze couldn't fill it anymore. Drugs couldn't fill it anymore. Things couldn't fill it anymore. As I told you, I had lost the mental ability to practice law. I had become licensed by the state of New York. I was certified as a high school teacher. I could teach because I could focus on one thing for a short period of time. I could do that. And I was a good teacher. I am a good teacher. But I had to, as my marriage began to unwind, an opportunity came up for me to go to a really good high school in the city of Buffalo. And I went there as a substitute assistant principal with a promise by the principal that as soon as there was an opening in the social studies department, he would hire me as a teacher. And I went there, and I had that job, and I couldn't take it. I would get the assignment at 10 minutes to 8 in the morning, and by 5 after 8, I'd be done with a whole day's worth of work. And I was like going nuts sitting in this place with nothing to do all day. I'm trying not to drink. You know, I'm really struggling with this drink thing. I'm trying not to, but I'm still drinking. So I decided that I'm going to try to go back to practice law. I didn't practice law from 1979 until October of 1987 when I went back to law. And I got this part-time job. I wanted to have a part-time job with a lawyer. I thought I could do that, be the substitute principal. And it turns out I couldn't be that I had to take the job full time. So I decided to try and do that, and it was horrible. It was such a struggle. After 8 years, there was so much rust on me, it was unbelievable. And I was so frustrated. Things that I had done routinely and with great professionalism were a tremendous struggle, and I made mistakes, and I was falling all over myself, and I knew the reason for that was my boss. You know, he was just such an idiot. He didn't understand, and the truth is, turned out he was a very compassionate man. He kept talking to me. He said, "Look, give yourself a break. You got to shake the rust off." But I heard that as, you know, you're no good, you're a bad lawyer. Things that the way I translated the world was unbelievable. I never heard what people really said to me. I made it up so that I could run away. But eventually, I I started practicing law, trying not to drink. My marriage just it fell apart. The two of us were unable to live as husband and wife. We separated, and that's when my program began to get serious. I went to counseling, another counselor. I was seeing an individual psychotherapist. I then went into group alcohol counseling and individual alcohol counseling and began to get exposed to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and to the real me. What I found out was that I am selfish and self-centered. And until I was convinced that any life run on self can hardly be a success, I would continue to live in this life of devastation and pain to the people around me. The book says that, we were the actor who wants to be the director. Our basic trouble is we're a self-seeker even when trying to be kind. That was me. I was a victim of the delusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of the world if only I manage well. He is self-centered. And that described me. That's exactly who I was. And when this marriage fell apart, I said to my therapist, I spent like 50 minutes, and I built this case. No, I can build cases. I'm a lawyer. I learned how to do this. I build this case that is so clear that what's happened in this marriage was my wife's fault, in that I was this victim, that she had somehow tricked me into marrying her and brought me into this personal hell of hers and had me trapped in there. So I get, and it's tough. This is a good story. I get done with that, and I say to him, Doc, I say, so why do you think I married her? Now, I know what his answer has got to be. Anyone would answer it, just the way I described it. And he paused and sort of put his hands up, looked at me, and he says, I think the reason that you got married was because that was the only thing in your life you hadn't failed at. And I had now failed at that. And like that, something happened at that moment. I felt it just tear away from me. I felt like I dropped 10 stories. And it was terrifying. Because I knew the jig was up. He was not buying my baloney. And I knew he was right. And that moment was terrifying to me, but it turns out to be a great moment because that's when I really began to focus on my alcoholism, not my wife's, and focus on my problems, not hers. And that, of course, Alcoholics Anonymous is all about looking at ourselves and taking us to that place where we see that driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of others and they retaliate. And that's the deal. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problems. Now, I thought selfishness and self-centeredness were the same thing, but it turns out they're not. Selfishness is, this is selfishness. If you have 10 pieces of candy and your mother says to you, share them with your brother, you give him 3 and keep 7 for yourself. That's selfish. Self-centered, when you're told the same thing, you give your brother 7 pieces, you keep 3 for yourself, but you tell the whole world about it. Right? It's always about us. So Bill says this. He says this on page 62 in the book, and it's important I think it's important for me to remember that, because the whole rest of the work is about seeing what a selfish, self-centered person does what that causes in the world around them, and what must be done to change that. So I was stepping on the toes of others, and they were retaliating, but I forgot about the step. All I saw was the retaliation, and so I perceived myself as a victim. That it was their fault, that they had caused these problems, that it wasn't something I had done, it was something they had done, and I lived that way, and that's delusional. It wasn't true. I wasn't seeing the world as it really is. That's what I had to learn. So in this third step, I learned a couple things. The four corners of my life without God are selfishness, resentment, dishonesty, and fear. That was the framework of the life that I lived in. No wonder no one could relate to me. No wonder no one could stay with me. Someone who's living on that basis is incapable of trust, is incapable of love, and that was me. I wanted to love. I wanted to be loving. I just thought, if only you would trust me and love me, then I will be the best, greatest lover in the whole world. But I was untrustworthy and unlovable, so I was asking someone to do something that was impossible for them to do. And it was always conditional. You do it first, then I will do it. If you do it, then I will. And today in Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned that that's not the deal. We just do it. We do the things that we're supposed to do because we're supposed to do them. Without reward, acclamation, we just do them. And if we do that, we get this tremendous joy, this wonderful peace. So the third step prayer says what we learn is that God is going to be our director. We're going to be the actor. He's the principal. We're the agent. He's the father. We're the child. I had to change my roles. I wanted to be the director. I wanted to be the father. I wanted to be the principal. And I can't live that way. I need a power to guide me, direct me, and protect me. So in this third step prayer, we say that we offer ourselves to God to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. As he will, build with me and do with me as you will. Whatever it is that you want to do with me or build with me, I'll do that. That takes great surrender. And then I ask him, relieve me of the bondage of self so that I may better do thy will. I wanted to be relieved of the bondage of self so that things would go well for me. You know, that's what I thought. Everything will be, I'll feel good, I'll be at peace. Everything will go my way. You know, I'm not drinking now. It's time for things to get better. Because at that time, when I first did this third step, and for several years, I thought that my drinking caused me to be a bad actor. I didn't know it was self. So relieve me of the bondage of self so that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties. Those are the bedevilments that we talked about in step two. Take away my bedevilments, my difficulties, my fear of people, my sense of uselessness, my prey, that I'm, my misery and my depression. Take those away so that victory over them will bear witness to those I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. So if today I am not suffering from those bedevilments, that is a testament to all of you that because of this power and this direction, his power, his love, and his way of life, I don't live that life of a self-centered person. I don't suffer from those bedevilments when I am connected to that power. But when I turn away from the power, they all come right back. They all come right back. There have been days when I've gotten up in the morning, and I spent a lot of time in the morning to connect with this power. And I finished, I had like the best meditation I've ever had. I walk across the hallway into the bedroom. My wife says good morning, and I'm miserable. I'm depressed. I can't believe she's saying this. Leave me alone. What happened between those few steps is that I forgot that my job is to live a life of service. So, and then we conclude that prayer with, may I do thy will always. And that's really what I hope to do. That's what I seek to do on a daily basis. I don't succeed, but at least I try to move in that direction. So we're going to take a break now. We got some pizza, and we'll come back in about 20 minutes. I'd like to thank the host for that pizza. It's delicious. It's really very good. If you come to Buffalo, we'll give you some real pizza. Just kidding. It was really, really wonderful pizza. At the end of that third step, we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood Him. And making that decision is very difficult. You know, faced with the fact that my marriage was being destroyed, that I was terrified every day trying to go into work. I was really unable to successfully practice my profession at that point in my life. I was isolated and separated from my family. I had one friend. You would think that it would be a pretty easy decision to say, well, no matter what you present to me, you got to be doing better than I'm doing here. Something's got to work. And yet I couldn't. It's a very difficult decision. So I understand when someone comes into AA and their life is a mess. They've been fired. They're getting divorced. They're not making any money. They come in here and they see us and they see the laughter and they feel it and they feel the love and they feel the power and they continue drinking because the prospect of experiencing the pain that these next steps are going to expose us to is just, it's too frightening. It's too overwhelming. One of the things that I need to remember is that the pain that we feel in Alcoholics Anonymous is psychic pain. It's emotional pain. It's not harmful pain. It's not like we're breaking arms or we have cracked bones or something. It's a psychic emotional pain. And in order to grow up, we have to go through this pain. Now, most people do this in adolescence. And by the time they're 20, 25 years old, they've gone through this process. They're not self-centered anymore. Their life is not built based on self. They think of other people, and they genuinely have a concern for the people in their lives and the people around them, for their employers and for their society. I lacked the power to do that. And here's what I think happened for me. I think when I took that first drink, I think I went from like 50 volts to 75. Like, I think everybody gets 50 volts of power, and then you have to get this additional power from somewhere. And all of my peers, most of them, still were operating at those 50 volts. And so for a long time, I deluded myself that I had more power than them. This alcohol gave me power. It changed me. It made me strong. It made me big. It made me courageous. It made me foolish. It made me sick. I didn't see those negative aspects of it. It made me angry. It made me anxious. It made me fearful. But I didn't see that. I saw that additional power, and I lived on that, and I tried to live on that additional power for the rest of my life. And I got to 40 years old, I still had 75 volts of power. All those other people, you know, those Baptists and those teetotalers and those moderate drinkers and those controlled drinkers, they had gone along and they got a couple volts of power here and a couple volts of power there, and God gave them a couple more volts. Yeah, and they just kept taking that power, and all of a sudden they got to 110 volts, and they're working just fine. The current's flowing through them fine. And they have some struggles with life, but they're not overwhelmed by them. Things aren't a big deal. Problems come along, they work with other people to solve them. I didn't do any of that. Lots of people offered me guidance and direction on how to access this power and how to get it and how to grow up and how to become an adult. But I didn't think I needed it, because you see, when I was 13 years old, I was an adult. I was a man. I was doing things that men do. I was drinking, I started smoking, I started gambling, I started to get involved on a sexual level with women. I was spending money like I had it. I'm creating this delusional world of power that I lack. I don't have it. I need those extra volts. And this is where I begin to get it, in the fourth step. In the fourth step, we inventory our negative emotions. It's an emotional inventory. We inventory anger, fear, and anxiety. He calls that sex relations. But it's relationships with people, and that creates great anxiety. If you don't know how to be an adult, you are anxious when you're talking with someone of the opposite sex. The anger that I feel, I'm mad at the people on whose toes I stepped and they retaliated. And I'm angry at them. And I think it's unfair what they've done. And I relive those feelings. I can't do it quite as much today as I could when I first came in. But when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, like, you could say a name. Ron Snyder. Bang, my mind would go to six things that he did when we were a kid. And that son of a bee, and, you know, this and that. And it was all right there. You could name any girlfriend that I had ever had. You could name my first wife, my parents, my brother, my sister, all of my employers. And I would go back to spots and I would just be filled with anger and filled with rage. I could re-feel that. And that's what resentment means. In Latin, it means to sentio, is to feel. So it's to re-feel it. At the time, it probably was not inappropriate for me to be angry or to be upset. And if I had been able to express that, they could have explained to me that, in fact, my perception of what they were doing to me was incorrect, and they would probably be able to point out to me some of my behaviors that they were responding to, and I would have been open to that, and we would have moved on. I was closed-minded to all of that. Closed-minded. Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness are the essentials to sobriety. And this is the beginning process. If I wrote the fourth step, I would still be in here telling you what they did to me. But I didn't write the fourth step. I turned my life and my will over to my higher power, and he said, here's an 18-inch pencil with a great big eraser. You hold a pencil, and I'll write this down. And every time I started writing something down, he erased it. We rewrote that list. Because it's the negative emotions that block me from the power, and I need to... That's the next layer. The first layer are the prejudices. Those are taken away as a result of the second and third step. And then in the fourth step, I have this next layer that surrounds me, and it's a layer of resentment, fear, and anxiety. And so long as those negative emotions are prevalent in my life, I can't connect to the power. It's a block to that power. Today, if I get angry, I try to express that anger as directly and as forthrightly and as quickly as possible. And what happens is the anger goes away. I can't afford to hold that in. Because if I hold it in, it blocks me from the power. That's why I do it. Not because I'm some nice guy or something. I want that power to be connected. I want to be connected to it. And if I don't express those emotions, I begin to behave just the way I did when I was an alcoholic. This should not be a surprise to us. On page 20 in the book, Bill Wilson says our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon the constant thought of others and what we can do to help meet their needs. So what that tells me is that if I'm not thinking of other people and what I can do to help meet their needs, I'm thinking about me. And if I'm thinking about me, I'm living a life as a problem drinker, right? If my life as an ex-problem drinker depends on those thoughts and I'm not having those thoughts, then by default, I'm living the life of a problem drinker again. Because the life wasn't created by the bottle. The bottle was a result of the life. It's the way that I behaved that caused me to drink, not the way that I drank that caused me to behave that way. And so I can experience all this in sobriety, and when I do, I get disconnected from the power. So what do we do about these resentments? I mean, they're eating us alive. And Bill Wilson says we need to pray for these people. So I'm going to tell you how this works. I had a lot of people, of course, and I did that, and I prayed for them, and I got some relief. But I had this big case, and I worked very, very hard on it. It was a difficult products liability case. The lawyer on the other side was a very well-known, well-respected, highly regarded personal injury defense attorney. Very difficult to deal with. He's probably a lot smarter than me. But I'm working on this case, and we go down one day to... we're going to have discovery. And the case involves a wire wheel brush and a defect in it. And so his expert is going to inspect the machine. So we go down, it's on videotape, and the guy takes the machine apart, and he's looking at this and that and describing what he's seeing and on and this and that. And then he goes to put it back together, and he can't get it back together. Now, this is my key piece of evidence. Before this guy took it apart, it didn't work. I mean, you could see it. You could see the defect in it. And so he consults with the lawyer. They talk for a couple minutes, and the lawyer says, "This deposition is over." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "This deposition is over with." And I said, "You can't stop now. He took that machine apart. He's got to put it back together." And he says, "This deposition is over with, we're leaving." He gets up with his witness and he leaves. And like I explode. I mean, I was sober maybe 7 or 8 years. I could feel it. It started in my spine. It blew through my head. I was out of my mind. I was crazy. So I came back to the office, and Dave was there, and I walked into his office, and I didn't even say anything. He just looked at me and he said, What's going on? What's going on?" And I said, "I'll tell you what's going on." And I went into a rant. I went crazy. He listens to me, and he says, "Well, Chuck, you know what you have to do." And I said, "Dave, forget it. I am not gonna pray for that guy. No way. It's not gonna happen. Forget it. I don't care if I drink. I'm not gonna pray for that bastard." He says, "Why don't you just take a walk? Why don't you just go down there and take a walk down Elmwood Avenue, walk for a little bit. Try to get in touch with your higher power. See what happens." So I'm walking, and I start praying. I'm not praying for him yet, but I start praying. I say, "You got to help me with this, God. Please help me. Please, please help me." And this voice says to me, "Chuck, you have his expert witness on videotape showing that he can't put the machine together, and your expert can." It was like wonderful. I couldn't have a better piece of evidence. They couldn't let this guy testify because his incompetence, with respect to this one particular device, he was unable to put it back together. And of course, here I was being given this gift in the case, and I'm like out of my mind. I'm ready to blow everything up and think this is the end of the world. And I prayed for him. I prayed for him, and years later, to tell you that I know it works, years later, when Dave's daughter got married, I was invited to the wedding, and Dave was, and I sat next to this guy at the wedding, and it was fine. It was fine. My wife was more worried about it than I was. So prayer works. We need to pray for those people and pray that they get relief and that they get whatever it is, you know, that they need to make their lives better. I went through the same thing with my first wife. You know, I started off saying, I can't pray for her. I don't want her to get anything. Then I started praying for a little bit. And then one day I say to her, I'm praying and I say, well, I want her to get just about everything that I want to get, but just a little bit less. And then one day I said, I don't care what I get. It doesn't matter. I have the life. I have this wonderful life. I have a place to go, people who love me. Whatever she can get, whatever she gets or needs or wants, I hope she gets it. Whatever it is. And to this day, I really feel that way. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. And at that moment, all the anger went away. And so we go from anger. The fear inventory is a key, and the anxiety inventory are keys. And I've talked enough on the fourth step. I'm going to turn it over to Dave. Thanks.
Thanks, Chuck. So now we're getting down to some tough stuff here. Some real work in AA. And I told you that probably nobody has resisted these steps more than I. So I think it's appropriate to read these two little paragraphs at the end of step one in the 12 and 12. And it says, why all this insistence that every AA must hit bottom first? The answer is that few people will sincerely try to practice the AA program unless they've hit bottom. For practicing AA's remaining 11 steps means the adoption of attitudes and actions that almost no alcoholic who is still drinking can dream of taking. Or in my case, not drinking, can dream of taking. Who wishes to be rigorously honest and tolerant? Who wants to confess his faults to another and make restitution for harm done? Who cares about anything about a higher power, let alone meditation and prayer? Who wants to sacrifice time and energy in trying to carry the AA message to the Next Supper? No. The average alcoholic, self-centered in the extreme, doesn't care for this prospect unless he has to do these things in order to stay alive himself. Under the lash of alcoholism, we're driven to AA, and there we discover the fatal nature of our situation. Step one. Then and only then do we become as open-minded to conviction and as willing to listen as the dying can be. We stand ready to do anything which will lift the merciless obsession from us. You know, and that's where I am at step four now. I'm restless, irritable, discontent. Life is not, I don't have a job. So I've got all this debt. All these freaking meetings. It's just a drag, man. I tell you, life is a drag. And I hear these guys saying to me that they drank again when they did not do the step. Book says that the reason for this is to discover the obstacles in our path. Now, none of these steps, not one of them, give us anything. They're all designed to take something away. Right? Chuck talked about the second step, taking away prejudices. Third step, taking away this idea that we're self-sufficient. Right? This step, discover, takes away these things that are blocking me from that higher power. At least it's the start of it. The bondage of self, really, in that third step, prayer, are all those things that I think are more important than a better relationship with my higher power. I can just fill in the blank, and I can fill in the blank any day. Money is more important. You know, how about the relationship with my daughter? Isn't that more important? All those things that focus on myself is my bondage of self. If I can focus on that higher power and how I can carry out his will, then I'm free of that bondage of self. So there was a guy at the University Men's Discussion Group, an old guy named Bill, and he said that his sponsor was in Toronto in 1965 at the International Convention. And his sponsor was standing with six or seven guys, and Bill Wilson was there too. And somebody said to Bill, given a society or a set of circumstances or something you could imagine that only one step could be practiced, which step would it be? Wilson said like that, oh, the fourth step, of course. Now, that would not have been my guess. I would have guessed the first, well, I don't know, 12th. But he said the fourth step, of course. So this, getting gone down to causes and conditions of my alcoholism, What's behind all this drinking I did? Why did I have to drink like that? We had this guy come in to speak to our annual convention, maybe 10 years ago, from Louisville, Kentucky. He's an addictionologist. He's an alcoholic. And he said, for years we doctors were looking at these alcoholics and drug addicts saying, what is wrong with these people? Why do they want to feel high all the time? What's wrong with them? He said, we were looking at the wrong thing. Alcoholics just feel crappy all the time. All they want to do is feel normal. I said, wow, that's right, man. I just didn't want to feel as lousy as I felt. He said, alcoholics are born feeling crappy. And we're in a world that's too loud and too much of a hassle and it's too colorful and too many people are on my back and why don't you leave me alone, Have a couple of drinks and that all goes away, What was I worried about? I'll take care of that tomorrow. Set them up. So the guys at the men's group also said, you don't have to overcomplicate this thing. Really, all we're talking about in the fourth step is money, power, and sex. Those are the three things that you want to control your life anyway, right? So they say, think of it this way. It's red, green, and pink. So what? What are you talking about? Red. You're angry. You're mad. You're pissed off. Green. Money. I need more money. That's my problem, right? Pink. Relationships. I need a relationship is what I need. In 1979, when I came into AA, the treatment centers had just, this idea of holding hands had just trickled into AA. I was so sick that at the end of a meeting, if I held the hand of a woman and there was the slightest amount of pressure, she loves me. I swear to God. Oh, man, I was love-starved, I'll tell you that. So on the 12 and 12, on page 49, it tells my story. So when AA suggests a fearless moral inventory, it must seem to every newcomer that more is being asked of him than he can do. Both his pride and his fear beat him back every time that he tries to look within himself. Pride says, you need not pass this way, and fear says, you dare not look. That's me, man. How do you get by those two things? I got by them because I was petrified of taking that next drink. So I got the fourth step, I got the big book and the four columns. I got the 12 and 12. I got the little red book. I got the Hazelton guide to a four-step inventory. The seven deadly sins. And I got all laid out in front of me, and I'm writing, and I'm writing, and I'm writing. And I was petrified of what kind of person I was going to find out I am. An inventory of myself, and what I'm afraid of is happening. I'm not the kind of person, I've told you I'm an actor, I'm not the kind of person I'm walking around pretending to be. I'm not. I'm under a $200 a week child maintenance and family maintenance order for my wife and three kids, and I'm entitled to $125 a week unemployment, and I'm too proud to go down and stand in the unemployment line and ask for that money to give to them because somebody might see me standing in line. The great Dave, that's the kind of, this is the stuff that's coming out, honestly, on this piece of paper. So I found out some big chunks of truth about myself. I didn't know what a resentment was. Somebody told me to look it up. And I looked at that time, I found the best, and I've looked it up a score of times since. The best definition is the first one I found. That is, a resentment is a feeling you've been treated unfairly. And that was my whole life. How about this alcoholism thing? Did I ask for that? That led me down this path, About her, that divorce, these debts, and the IRS, the shame I had of disgracing this profession that was good to me. I was kind of a notorious drunk, at least in my mind, downtown. In fear, what is this? What am I afraid of? And the 12 by 12 tells me that too. It says fear that you're going to lose something you have or not get something you think you're entitled to. And that holds true today. And one of the problems with having things, a car, a house, television, whatever, one of the essence of owning anything is a fear it'll go away. The house will burn down, a fear of that, the car will get stolen, I'll get in an accident, somebody will hit it, somebody's going to steal this, I'll give money to a broker, he's going to lose it for me. You know, anything that we own, built into that ownership is this fear it's going to go away. Now, that's not unhealthy, but for an alcoholic it is, right? Too much of that fear will drive me crazy. When my mom died, she had a couple of stocks and bonds, and I inherited them. And I found out that there was a way on the internet that you could track things that went up and down. You could put in General Motors, and you could push a couple buttons, and it would tell you at any time during the day if General Motors had gone up that day or down that day. And I became freaking obsessed with it. It wasn't a lot of money. It was just some shares and various stocks. And I would look at it, and I would, I'd go in the morning, look at it. Then I'd look at it morning and noon. Then I'd look at it at 10 o'clock in the morning. Then I would, and I'm looking at what it went up. I think to myself, I didn't do anything to deserve that. I didn't put any input to that going up. I don't deserve that. And if it went down, it's screwed again. Right? It was crazy. So finally, I made up my mind that these stocks, what we had, in my mind, I just made this decision, belong to God and my wife. They're hers. I don't, if it goes up or down, that's her problem. I don't care what she does with them. God, you relieve me of this fear that I have here. It's crazy. And then the last inventory we take is the sexual inventory. You probably heard the story of how do you know when two AAs have had their second date? There's a moving van in one of their driveways. In two pages in the big book, when it talks about the sexual inventory, it talks about an ideal that we have. And it asks us to have an ideal when we're thinking about our sexual dysfunction. Right? So we're talking about this at Chuck's and I's Step Action meeting one night. And we say to people, do you want to share about your ideal? You know? And one guy raises his hand, he goes, well, Pamela Anderson is my ideal. No, Billy, it's not about your ideal of the other person. It's about what kind of ideal do you want? You know, what about your ideal? What is the ideal husband, the ideal boyfriend, the ideal partner? Another guy said, another woman said, her sponsor said to her, that her ideal man should be an old guy with a very large IRA. We said, no. We're not talking about the ideal there. We're talking about an ideal for yourself. So we write down what kind of husband do I want to be? How do I want to look to my spouse? You know, how do I want to look to my kids? What kind of father? How would an ideal father in Dave's mind look? What would he look like? And we write that down. And then we have something to measure ourselves by. One guy came to our meeting one night, a Hispanic guy, I'd never seen before or since. And he said his sponsor told him to write down his ideal of the kind of father and husband he is supposed to do and be and keep it in his glove compartment. And when you drive, he says, when I drive into that garage at night, before I go in that house, I read that before I go in that house. So I can figure out how I'm supposed to act to those kids and that woman when I walk through that door. And I thought, wow, now that's some recovery, man. That is some idea. That's some AA. So now I have, it talks about inventory of a business inventory. You find out what's on the shelf and you throw out what's bad and what is unsaleable and you're left with good things, you know. And so now I have a shelf of my dysfunction. I have a shelf of my character defects. I have a shelf full of resentments. I have a shelf full of fears. And I have a shelf full of sexual dysfunction. All right, so now I know what my character defects are. What's next? Well, what do you mean? I got to talk to somebody else about that? Admit it to ourselves, to God, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. So that's exactly what it means. But how about admitting to ourselves? What does that mean? I wrote it all down. Isn't that enough, admitting it to myself? Well, maybe, maybe not. My first spouse used to talk a lot about what is your motive. What's your motive, Dave, and how honest are you? Are you being honest here? So I got to read over what I found out about myself and ask myself, is this an honest inventory? Is this really honest? Does something else have to go on there? Have I just too ashamed to put down X, Y, and Z? If I am, I got to put it down. And how about admitting to God? Doesn't God know everything anywhere? Well, here's how God fits into the fifth step, I think. When I hear a fifth step from somebody, I say to them, where's it going to be three of us in this room? You're going to tell me what you wrote down, but we're going to invite God to be like here with us. Help me be a good listener. Help you speak honestly. Let's see what we can do. Let's just get him involved in this whole process. That's admitting to God the exact nature of our wrongs, because he's here with us, as you're telling me.
Excuse me.
I was sober maybe 6 months this time, and a guy at the University of Men's discussion group, who was an old, long-time AA, maybe 10 years or something like that. The rumor was, blah, 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 buzz, 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 buzz. Jimmy drank. What? I met him. Wasn't he sober a long time? Yeah, yeah. He drank. I mean, he drank. How could he? It's 10 years sober. How could he drink? And somebody at the table said, maybe there was something, Dave, that he never could let go of. Maybe there was something so dark in his past he was never able to push it through this process we have here. Was never able to write it down. Was never able to talk to another person about it. And it finally ate him up. And that was a revelation to me. I didn't know that that could be a problem. And I see that today. You know, I see that today. That's why this daily inventory we take, which we'll talk about this evening, is so important to me. To see how I am doing today, you know. I wake up every morning with a new case of alcoholism. I'm convinced of that. I don't have yesterday's alcoholism. I have today's alcoholism. And so today I better do something to place my higher power between me and that next drink today. Now, that's not a burden today. It's not. But I have a healthy respect for my next drink, which I believe, by the way, has been brewed and is sitting at a bar somewhere. I think it's in a bottle right now, my next drink. I don't know if it's in the top supermarket. I don't know if it's in one of the bars I pass on the way to the meetings. I don't know if it's in Florida when I go on vacation. I don't know where it is, but I have this feeling it's got my name on it somewhere, you know? So I talk to my sponsor. I tell my sponsor that my inventory is done. How am I on time? You know? How am I on time?
We have 31 minutes left on the TV, but Chuck, I think it's only
13 minutes. Great. So I talk to my sponsor, and I say, Tom, my inventory is done, but you know, there's this guy I knew from high school. His name is Peter. He's got three kids. He's been sober about 3 years. He's divorced, and we've kind of been hooking up and going to meetings and whatever. Would it be okay if I had told my fifth step to Peter? And Tom said, absolutely, Dave. That's a terrific idea. Very good idea. So I'm living in this little place over on the west side of Buffalo, and I tell Peter, I would say, will you come over this night and hear my fifth step? He says, sure, I'd be happy to. So he comes over and we have sandwiches and we have coffee and then we sit down in my little living room. And I start reading him the stuff that I have on this yellow pad. And it's tough, Art, man, I'll tell you. And I skip over stuff and I say, no, wait a minute, I got to go back and I got to tell you that. And I go on and on and on. And he must have had a date or something that night, because every once in a while he says, can I make a call, Dave? Would you mind if I made a call? Oh, go ahead. Pick up. I could hear him from the other room. I don't know. I have no idea. As soon as I can. <You know. laughs> More time to go by. We'd walk around the block and blah, blah, blah. Dave, excuse me, may I make a call? Maybe not tonight. I don't know. You know. But I did it, you know, and I told him all those things that I had written down about the true self, my true self, till thine own self be true. You know? And And as of that date, whenever that was between my first and second year, that was as good as I could do on that date. And that was good enough. That's all. AA is not a perfection thing. You know, we just do as good as we can on a daily basis. And he left, and the next day I'm talking to my sponsor, and I said to my sponsor, you know, I thought I was going to have like some tremendous relief, like all this stuff was going to be flying away from me. What I said, I don't feel like all the relief I thought I'd feel. But you know how I felt? You know what happened to me in that fifth step? Because I felt like I belonged in AA. I could go to those tables where they talked about the fifth step, and I wouldn't have to keep my mouth shut or pass or whatever. You know, I could share my experience in my fifth step.
Why, when I had my fifth step, you know, last week.
You know, I did. I felt like I was a card-carrying member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So a couple weeks later, there's this old guy in AA named Mel. Mel's maybe, if I'm 2 years sober, he's like 5 years sober. And he says, would you do my fifth step? I said, sure, absolutely. Come on over, we make a date. He comes over to the house, we have the sandwiches, we have the coffee. I know the chair to sit in where you give a fifth step. If I know the chair you sit in when you hear a fifth step. So, so I go ahead, all right, Mel, go ahead, shoot. I take a deep breath, and he says, well, when I was 17, I blah, 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 blah. And then when I was 22 years old, my father and I, blah, blah, blah. Boy, he says, do I feel better? I said, what? He goes, yeah, what a great program. I can't tell you how relieved I am. Just, I said, you haven't even had the coffee yet. That's it? Yeah, what a great program. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening to that. See ya. He died with like 28 years sobriety. That's what he had to do. That's all he had to do. He didn't have to complicate it like I complicated it. I wrote down a little thing here that I found when I was looking at my stuff, and it says, the Buddha, and I love this, said, talked about the bliss of blamelessness. Where we have, when we have no secrets, living cleanly, a sense of safety arises. We're not looking over our shoulder. And of course, that's coupled with our ninth step, which we'll talk about later. But I love that, because I think that's what happens in AA. I'm not walking around with all that crap, all those things I did that I regret, whatever. I'm just not walking around with us anymore. And by the way, I heard a fifth step from a guy who's 12 years sober this year, and he starts back at the beginning again. And I think, I say to him, haven't you ever done a fifth step before? He says, oh, yeah. I said, so what's all this stuff about your grammar school teachers? And didn't you put that down? Oh, yeah. He says, but that's what... Oh, man. You got some work to do on 6, 7, man, and 8, and 9. You shouldn't, 12 years sober, if you've done fifth steps before, you shouldn't be carrying this stuff around. The promise here is that stuff's going to go. So, 5, 4, and 5 for me?
Yeah.
Good enough. Thanks.
So one of the reasons we need to get rid of these thoughts is that our mind is like a one-car garage. And if you have anger in there, there's no room for love. And if you have fear in there, there's no room for love. And if you have anxiety in there, there's no room for love. And all that I wanted when I was drinking was I wanted to love. And I wanted to be loved. And I was a person who placed that impediment. I parked that car in that garage, and there was no room for love. So I couldn't learn how to love. The power that we get is love. That's, you know, the higher power is love. I think the higher power says to us, you are my beloved. How can I help you? You are my beloved. How can I help you? And I, you know, I could never say that. I couldn't think about that. all that I thought about was how I really want to love you. Why don't you let me? And I don't want you, I want you to love me, but I don't want you to do anything. And if you don't do anything, I'm going to be mad at you because you didn't do anything. You know, I have this crazy mind that lives in this delusional world. And so it's impossible. It's impossible to love if we can't think of others. And all that I thought about was myself. Bill says selfishness and self-centeredness. That is the root of our problems. He says, in this book you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope that you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. And that's the beginning of this process. And as I got relief from some of this anger and some of this fear and some of this anxiety, and I had never been able to get that relief, I knew something was working out there. So after we complete this four-step inventory, we see who we were angry at, why we were angry at them, how it affected us. You know, this is the things I thought, my self-esteem, my pride, all of these things that I thought they had done to me. And I could write that. We could end it there. I could write that thing. I was pretty good at that. I knew all those things. Here's where God came in. God came in because God showed me how I behaved. He showed me my behaviors. He began to reveal to me the behaviors of someone who was selfish and self-centered. And he showed me that those behaviors caused people to react. And their reactions were interpreted by me as personal attacks. So, why do we have to do this fifth step? The book says if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. And I was sober a few months, I think 4 or 5 months, and I had to... I had to come over here to the appellate for depositions to Rochester. I had the depositions in a law firm here on a sex discrimination case. And it's an hour and a half from Buffalo to Rochester. And we had 6 hours of tapes of this guy, Ray O'Kay. And Ray was a lawyer. And I had the great pleasure to meet him as well as his sponsee, Jack Keegan. And Ray had given this talk in Miami, and he talked a half hour in each step, so 12 steps. It was 6 hours, and I'm riding back and forth. I had to do this twice. It was exactly 6 hours, so I heard it. And as he's describing this, he talks about coming to AA, being sober for a while, not doing the fourth and fifth step, and getting drunk. And he says, if I don't do this, these two steps, I'm going to get drunk. And he got sober and he did those steps. And so I got back to my apartment. I was excited. I started writing down this four-step list. And the first time I did it, I used the 7 deadly sins. And I knew that I hadn't written it. Because the things that I thought were irrelevant in my life that didn't apply, like it was pages of stuff. And the things that I thought I was really a pretty horrible person at sort of came out. I was what I was, but not what I had made up in my mind. I have this lack of perception. What I think is big is small. What I think is small is big. What I think is relevant is irrelevant. What I think is irrelevant is relevant. So it's very difficult. That's an unmanageable life. And I looked at that list, and I got excited. I was like, my God, I'd done this. I couldn't believe it. So I called Dave and made an appointment to do my fifth step. And he called, and I had it sitting on my table. The day before, he called and said something had come up. Could we reschedule it? And I said, yeah, sure, of course. So we reschedule it. Now, it's sitting here on my table every night when I come home. I wasn't worried about anyone finding it because no one was coming home with Chuck B. at that time in my life. So we're ready. We're going to do it again. And Dave calls up and says, something else came up. Can we reschedule? And so now, I said, yeah, sure. But then I think, yeah, what? This is probably ridiculous. I don't think I really need to do this. This is God's message to me. Two appointments, two cancellations. Why bother, right? We made a third appointment, and we did do the fifth step, and it was a very powerful experience. The book says that you have not completed the fifth step until you have told your whole story to someone, until someone has heard your whole story, and you tell that to the person in the presence of God. And then in the 12 and 12, it adds that in order to complete the fifth step, you not only must have told someone your whole story, but you must have heard their story. And so the role of the sponsor becomes very, very important in this process, because as I was telling my story, Dave told me his story. And now we've heard each other's stories so many times, either one of us could stand up here and tell you the other one. I know his story as well as I know mine, and it's very important. That helps me. But it was hearing his story that made me understand that, because Dave was my sponsor. I was in early sobriety, and I admired him. I wanted to have what he had. If you don't think that your sponsor is the best sponsor in the whole world, keep looking. If you don't think your home group is the best home group in the whole world, keep looking. Because for every alcoholic, there's a home group and a sponsor that is the right fit for them, the right person. And I didn't want to tell him these things about myself. That was very, very embarrassing things. I didn't know how I was going to tell him that I had declared bankruptcy. I didn't know how I was going to tell him I had mismanaged that law firm and run it into the ground. I didn't know how I was going to do that. And so we invited God in, and I told him those things, and I knew that I wasn't speaking. I knew that because I didn't want him to know that. I was sure that if I told him that, when we got done, that he would say, well, Chuck, that was, that was good. Nice job in the fifth step. Maybe you better find another sponsor. We're probably not a pretty good fit here. And of course, he didn't say that at all. What he said was it just what it says in the book. Think about what we've read. Take some time, think about it, and give me a call if you want to talk some more about it. And like I just cried after he left it. My God, he said it's okay to call him. And it was such relief because I was so sure that that was not going to happen. But what happened when I got done with this fifth step is I knew my story. And now I had something to tell. Up until then, my role in Alcoholics Anonymous was in service. Greeter, coffee maker, anniversary chairperson. Wasn't sober enough to be a treasurer, even though I thought I should be chairing all these groups. No one was asking. But I had jobs in AA, and that began to give me a sense of usefulness. And it allowed me to feel good about myself. And in the end, what this is all about is we stay sober, we come here today, and we help others, not because it helps us to not drink, but because of the wonderful way it makes us feel inside. The joy that we feel from selfless giving. And I had never experienced that, ever. Ever. Until Dave told me his story one-on-one, and I saw that. He had no agenda. It didn't matter. Whatever I said, he was open to what I was going to say, and he wasn't going to judge me. And I knew that God was there because I talked about things that I knew I couldn't talk about. So I knew there was another power. I knew there was some power. I didn't know what it was yet, but the power was revealing itself to me. It was taking away some of those negative emotions. It was opening up that garage so that love could go in there. In the fifth step, the power was there because it helped me to tell my story. It revealed my story to me. And in the end, that's all that we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous is our story. I can't fix anybody and I can't heal anybody. In the family afterward, the book says our deepest, darkest secrets are our greatest possession. For with them, we can help another alcoholic and save their lives. And that my ability to talk about these things that I was so frightened about, to talk about, can help someone else who's suffering from that same problem. I've told this story and had people come up to me afterwards and say, you know, when you said this, this happened to me. And I've never talked about that before with anyone. And I know the relief that they're feeling, because when I talked about that stuff, it was great relief. It was things that I had hidden inside me. I'd screwed that cap on tight. You know, I was holding it all in. And now the pressure is being backed off and it's starting to dissipate. And it's a wonderful feeling. We push the memories of our actions far inside ourselves, hoping that they will never see the light of day. This puts us under constant fear and tension. That makes for more drinking. So I have to be relieved of that. And I had no intentions. I mean, when I put that stuff inside me, no one was ever going to hear this again. I didn't want anyone to know that. And I couldn't live a life of honesty and a straightforward life. So the fifth step, Bill says, we must be entirely honest with someone if we expect to live long or happily in this world. He should know that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. It's a life and death experience when we talk about this fifth step, because without it, it's possible that we will return to drinking. They're wonderful fifth step promises. The fifth step promises are on page 75 in the book. And there's seven fifth step promises. So you can always remember that. 7 and 5 on 75. Once we took this step with holding nothing, we are delighted. And here are the promises. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have held certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel that we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Those are really, they're wonderful, wonderful promises. There's a difference between loneliness and solitude. When I was alone, my loneliness, I was filled with self-pity. I was filled with fear. It was an invention of the lower power that I was alone. The reality is I can never be alone. If there are no other human beings in my presence, I'm always in the presence of this power. And the awareness of that converts what used to be loneliness into solitude. And to know that I am safe, and that whatever I do, so long as that power is guarding and directing me, all will be well. And that loneliness began to disappear after this, because that power was there. I could feel it. I used to feel it in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what kept me coming back. But what happened was that it went beyond that. It went beyond the feeling in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I now experienced it outside of the rooms, and I experienced it in my own apartment. A miraculous thing happened not too long after I did that fifth step. I was able to go to my apartment and do one thing. I didn't have to have the television on, the radio on, talking on the phone, working on the computer. I could just do one thing. And that was like amazing. And I could do nothing. I could sit and not listen to TV, watch TV, listen to the radio, listen to the stereo. I could just sit and be at perfect peace and ease. And that was really remarkable. Derek, how are we doing time-wise here?
10 minutes.
Okay, well, I'll talk a little bit then on the sixth step. The sixth step is a step that separates the men from the boys. And it's very short in the big book. It's only one paragraph long. They devote a great deal of time to the sixth step in the 12 and 12. And it's in this sixth step that I learned a number of things. Number one, I learned that those behaviors that I identified in the fourth step that people responded to, that those were my defects of character. And that I thought about myself, and because of that, I was prideful and angry and lustful and envious. I was gluttonous, I was avaricious, and I was slothful. I was manipulative, abusive, and controlling. I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. And that's how I tried to work my way through life. Now, in the fifth step, it says that we admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And the exact nature is told to us by Bill Wilson. I thought I had to figure this thing out, and I took the fifth step a few times. The nature of my wrong is that I'm a liar, I'm a cheat, I'm a thief, I'm manipulative, all those things. And I would try to add to that list, and that was the nature of my wrongs. But the book says the exact nature of my wrongs is that I'm selfish and self-centered. It says that on page 62, and the fifth step is an admission that is in fact what my nature is. And because of that nature, I behave in a way that's wrongful. And so eventually I got to the place where I could admit that the nature of my wrongs is selfishness and self-centeredness, and I wanted to get rid of it. And in this sixth step, I really wanted to get rid of it, you know. I thought after I'd done that fifth step that I was entirely ready. I was entirely ready to have these defects of character removed. What I thought that meant was, well, now that I'm not drinking and I'm entirely ready, I can do the things I always did, but without the consequences. I thought, I'm not drinking, so I won't lie. I'm not drinking, so I won't cheat. I'm not drinking, so I won't steal. I began to see in my life how I was always just a few short. You know, I was a few lies short of being a liar. So, like, I would set the bar and say, well, if anyone says 100 lies, they're a liar. And then I'd get to, like, 96, and I would say, well, how silly of me. Everyone tells 100 lies in their life. That should be 250. And as I creeped up on that 250, I think, well, look, I'm still young. Coming up on 250 lies, I got another 40 years. I better make that 1,000. And then I start creeping up on that 1,000. I just would keep raising the bar. So I was always just a few short of being a liar. What I learned in the sixth step was that if you tell a lie, you're a liar. If you cheat somebody, you're a cheat. And that was really a revelation to me. That there's no degrees of this. If you lie, you're a liar. That's it. And once I could see that and understood that, that ancient enemy, rationalization, was defeated. But the lower power was always putting in front of me this belief that I could live an immoral life and get a spiritual result. I wanted peace, joy, love, patience, tolerance, kindness. That's what I wanted to come from the things that I did. But the things that I did produced pain, sorrow, fear, anxiety. You know, I wanted to be able to behave the way I always did, but get a different result. The way I like to describe it is that in my life, I was in an orange grove and I was looking for apples. And I would always go for that orange, and it would never taste like an apple. Now, the way the lower power works is it would hold that orange in its hand and it would say, "How would you like an apple?" And I wanted so much for that to be an apple that I went for it. And going for it, I harmed someone because I lied to them, I cheated, I stole, whatever. I used people, I abused people, I manipulated them. And the lower power would never tell me that it was an apple. It just suggested that. Good, necessary, and kind, helpful. That was the way it was presented. And I would go after that, and I was disappointed every time. I wanted something external to give me something internal, and it can't happen. External things can never give me internal peace. That comes from the destruction of ego. And ego spent the first 40-some years of my life and a few years into sobriety trying to convince me that something external would make me feel better. And I wanted to get rid of that. I wanted to get rid of that feeling. And I couldn't. I didn't know how to do it. I thought I did. I would take vows, and I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to behave that way anymore. Finally, I was brought to my knees. I found out that I can't change the way that I am. I have to have God's help with that. I didn't behave the way I did because of the way I drank. I drank the way I did because of the way I behave. And I behave in a way that causes great disturbance inside of me. And if I continued to behave that way, I knew that I would return to drinking. As an alcoholic, I suffer from stinking thinking. And you've heard that before. We had our friend Ken was over at the Buffalo 12-step weekend a few years ago. And he described that stinking thinking. Some of the examples he gave were overgeneralizing. You know, I stub my toe and I think the end is near. He says, we suffer from mind reading. And that was my thing. You know, I could read your mind. So I can imagine the people who try to be in relationship with me. Like they would come down the stairs, maybe grimace or something, and I would think, that's it, they're mad at me. And I would like react to that for the whole day. My poor first wife, I would determine by the clothes that she had on whether or not I thought she was having an affair that day. And I would go crazy thinking about these things. I could read her mind. You know, I knew that. Kreskin, we can predict the future. Now, I know how, when I was drinking, the future was, this will end badly. I could never see a positive result, ever. I was a really negative person. We have lack of proportion, and the book talks about that. We have an astonishing lack of perspective. Things that really are inconsequential, like blow into monumental events, and things that I really should be concerned with, I treat as though they're irrelevant. The shoulda, woulda, coulda. I mean, that was always, I should have done this, I would have done this, I could have done this. And that drove people nuts. Because all they want to talk about is, what did you do? And I don't want to hear that. You know, well, I should have done this, well, I could have done this, well, I would have done this if you would have told me. You know, if you hadn't kept it to yourself. Of course, I hadn't asked. Another form of stinking thinking is fault finding, where I was always finding fault. How are we doing over there? Cut? Stop? Okay, good.